Welcome to Guerrilla Radio. Well, if watching, listening, or reading media, especially in the era of forever electioneering, feels like being caught in the middle of a Three Stooges slap fest, then I have good news for you. There is at least one alternative to getting your ears boxed, eyes poked, and gut punched every time you attempt to become informed. Counterpunch.org is a venerable first comer in online news aggregating that has not only weathered the myriad alt-news imitators that followed its last century DC newsletter beginnings, but is too still standing amid the overwhelming corporatization of internet news on both sides of the political spectrum. But, as with all bearers of bad news, its survival is precarious. Right now, Counterpunch is appealing to its millions of readers and listeners to pony up and keep this vital service viable. Eric Dratzer is a New York City-based independent geopolitical analyst whose articles and interviews can be found at his site, stopimperialism.org, and at Counterpunch. He's also the host of Counterpunch Radio. Eric Dratzer in the first half. And last week, Denny Island-based ecology observer Igmar Lee reported on the sinking of the Kirby Corporation oil tanker tug Nathan E. Stewart, about 20 kilometers north of his home near Bella Bella. Almost 2 weeks later, the Nathan E. Stewart sits yet at the bottom of the Seaforth Channel, its fuel tanks emptying into the environment. So much for world-class oil response. Igmar Lee in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher emeritus Janine Bancroft will be here at the bottom of the hour to bring us up to speed with some of the good things planned for our neighborhood and beyond in the coming week. But first, Eric Dratzer and ponying up for the good cause. Stick around. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Eric, I've been a huge fan of Counterpunch for many years, and many of this program's guests I first came across over there at counterpunch.org. How is it, Eric, that you came to get involved with Counterpunch?
Well, I've been a reader of Counterpunch for years now, going back to easily before the Iraq War. I certainly recall being a 16-year-old kid, just kind of sort of getting into questioning political issues, questioning world affairs and the dominant narrative. And specifically, I recall the bombing of Kosovo or the bombing of Serbia during the Kosovo conflict by the Clinton administration. And NATO, of course. And I remember being taught both in a discussion in one of my high school courses and in general from the corporate media that what the United States was doing was a good thing, that this was in fact a humanitarian operation, and that, as always, the United States used its military force for good. And then I came across this place called Counterpunch, where I saw a distinctly different narrative from a left perspective that said, in fact, no, not only is this not humanitarian, this is an example of imperialism. Once again, the United States using military force in order to achieve political objectives in a volatile region. And that's a pretty powerful counter-narrative to discover when you're really just forming your political views and your political perspectives. And I've been a fan of Counterpunch since then and have gone through my own political evolution that's been quite astounding if I step back and take a look at it. And in many ways, Counterpunch has been quite instrumental in that political evolution. Now, as to how I got specifically involved with Counterpunch, I started as a contributor, contributing articles about 4 years ago, give or take. And in doing that, I came in touch with the editors and got to know them a little bit. And then the subject of putting together a podcast came up, and I said, hey, I've done that before. I know how to do that. And they said, go for it. And here we are.
Well, you know, in the introduction, I mentioned both sides of the political spectrum. Well, you know, this show began around that same time you described, when the bombs were falling on Belgrade in the late 1990s. And it was considered at the time a left-wing cause. Interventionism was good in this case. Milosevic, the then leader of Serbia, was Hitler incarnate, the first of many incarnated Hitlers to follow, as it turns out. But the spectrum, Eric, the left-right spectrum, seems to have undergone a change probably even as profound as your own over these years. Do you describe Counterpunch as maybe a limited left-wing hangout?
No, I would say that Counterpunch is, in many ways, upholds the core values of what it means to be on the left. Open-minded discussion, freedom of speech, upholding the freedom of speech, upholding the right to resist against the dominant narrative. I mean, a lot of these things, these are core values, at least in the minds of many people who consider themselves leftists, radicals, socialists, communists, anarchists, radical progressives, whatever they want to call themselves. These are supposed to be some of the principal bedrock of what it means to be on that part of the political spectrum. Unfortunately, and I think to your point, a lot of the left is in many ways co-opted. That includes the so-called left alternative media, or what I would maybe call a pseudo-alternative media. Mm-hmm. Partially because of financial ties to foundations and NGOs and all of the other aspects of the, call it the left wing of the empire. At the same time, I think it's also pretty clear that much of the left speaks with single voice on issues, whereas Counterpunch actually provides differing perspectives. For instance, there are articles that come in 180-degree opposite perspectives on issues like Syria, on issues like Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, on issues such as Bernie Sanders' campaign. Counterpunch ends up being a space that we have on the left in the alternative media where we can fight out these issues, where we can hash them out, and we can have discourse. And I think that is not only highly valuable, I think it's really essential at this point, especially as the alternative media landscape continues to shrink and shrink and shrink and be ever more controlled by the powers of finance capital.
Well, you know, it's a sense of deja vu all over again for me and for anybody old enough, I suppose, to remember. I mean, again, going back to Yugoslavia, we had Mr. Clinton in the White House, the current aspirant to the White House's husband, of course. And this war against Serbia confused a lot of people on the left that we were supposed to be doing the right thing and this was the right thing. We see the same sort of confusion carrying on, maybe in Libya, maybe even to some extent in Iraq. But now, as you mentioned, Syria, now we've got the son of Bill, or wife of Bill at least, now beating the drum to go in for another humanitarian intervention in Syria. What does a Clinton II presidency mean in your mind, Eric, vis-a-vis foreign policy?
Well, it means a ramping up of aggression. It means a widening of the wars that are already ongoing, perhaps also the potential to start new and bigger wars. Mm-hmm. It means that the empire will continue to function rather seamlessly, and that's actually one of the principal understandings that people, especially those outside the United States, outside of, you know, a very small community of politically minded activists, that's what needs to be understood, that the presidential figurehead is actually mostly irrelevant. It's about the functioning of a complex system, an imperial system, one with many moving parts that interlock, with many moving aspects to it that continue to change their tactics, and we need to be paying attention to that. And I've argued repeatedly that not only is Hillary Clinton part of that, but as is Donald Trump, as is every other candidate of any of the major parties who actually seek to get to the White House, because you essentially become the CEO of the military-industrial complex. And ultimately, that's what Hillary is vying for. That's what she's going to become. And I have no doubt in my mind that it's really just a formality at this point for her to be coronated as the president or the queen of chaos, as Diana Johnstone has said in Counterpunch, in her book Queen of Chaos, published by Counterpunch as well. And I think that that's something that needs to be considered. What does it mean for the United States and for the world that Hillary Clinton is going to be president at the very moment that she's doing things like warmongering against Russia, when she she's doing things like calling for a no-fly zone in Syria, which anybody who has studied the last 25 years of U.S. military operations knows no-fly zone is, by definition, a prelude to war. So given all of that, given her position on Ukraine, on Syria, on Libya, on Yemen, on many other issues, I think that one could reasonably expect that the U.S. military industrial complex is ready for a major, major boost.
Well, Eric, and Diana Johnston, been on this show. I found her writings at Counterpunch, and it's maybe this attempt to reach the presidency, as Chris Floyd would say, another alumnus of Counterpunch, is climbing that greasy pole, and he questions the moral turpitude of anybody who would even aspire to such a thing. Well, Eric, if nothing else, Counterpunch always has a way of tweaking. They challenged even the sacred cow Bernie Sanders during his campaign before his fall, and were critical when none on the left were really willing to be critical of Bernie Sanders. But it was different at Counterpunch. Now, you've written an article just out today. I see, "Dear Liberals, Trump is right." Now, it looks like you're looking for a fist fight, but you say Trump is, by his mere questioning of the holy writ of NATO scripture, Trump is the first presidential candidate in decades to substantially raise the issue of America's military power projection in Europe and around the world. Well, how does Trump fit into this model that you just described as the president being merely the CEO of America under the industrial military complex's control, or perhaps having one of those little phony pretend steering wheels stuck to the passenger side and pretending to drive the ship of state?
Well, I just to clarify something, I was merely noting that Trump has raised the issue. I say right in the, I believe in the sentence right after that, that I'm not suggesting that Trump is looking to make peace or that Trump is some kind of an anti-imperialist figure or anything like that. He merely raised a particular question that is important. And in fact, the thrust of that article, really the main topic of that article, has nothing to do with NATO. It's really about Trump's assertion that U.S. Elections are rigged, that they are crooked, that they are controlled and manipulated, which is fundamentally true. It is correct. We've seen it in 2000. We've seen it in 2004. We've seen it over and over and over again. There is ample documented evidence to really raise serious questions about the validity of U.S. election results. That's what the article is really about. So I'm not suggesting Trump is right on a host of issues. In fact, I think he is utterly reprehensible in most ways. But he does raise some interesting questions. He does raise some interesting topics that liberal America does not want to address, because to do so would undermine the mechanism, meaning elections and voting, would undermine the mechanism that validates their own power. Liberals, Democrats, and Republican, you know, conservatives, they need these elections in order to justify their own existence, in order to validate their right to govern. And if you begin to call into question in a serious way, in the mainstream, call into question the very validity of those elections, and you start presenting documented evidence of tampering, evidence of irregularities, evidence of vote suppression, evidence of any number of nefarious activities around U.S. elections, you now have attacked and undermined one of the principal mechanisms of power. That's what I'm getting at. Donald Trump raising that point doesn't make Donald Trump worth supporting. It does make Donald Trump worth listening to.
Well, what role, Eric, do you think that Trump plays in this whole thing? I mean, he couldn't have got this far by accident. I mean, if the power elite are controlling everything in the political sphere, at least at that at the top levels of American life, what role is Trump playing here?
Well, I don't believe that Trump is some kind of completely controlled candidate. I do think that Trump is sort of constitutionally unable to play the game in the right way. Trump is in many ways unpredictable in terms of what he'll say, but Trump is very predictable in terms of what policies he would pursue. Let's not forget, and I wrote this up in Counterpunch as well, I believe March 30th of this year, the article was "President Trump, U.S. War Machine Rolls On." And let's keep in mind that Trump's advisors are the same people who were advising Mitt Romney on foreign policy, who were advising George Bush on foreign policy. Trump's financial and economics advisor is the former business partner of George Soros. He is a Wall Street insider, if there ever was one, with running with a pack of hedge fund vultures. This is the person who is advising Trump. So if you think that Wall Street and the military industrial complex is not fundamentally in bed with Donald Trump, then I don't think you're paying attention. Now, obviously, I'm not saying you. I'm just speaking in general here. And
This is part of
the game that needs to be understood. When you control both sides, you're able to dictate outcomes.
Yeah, I got the feeling that he is like a stalking horse. His role there is to make these outrageous statements and just to gauge how the American public responds to them. I mean, it's a given that Clinton will be placed in power, or at least in the position of the presidency. But people are watching Trump and watching the American public and seeing how much of his out there message they'll put up with. That's my theory.
Well, there's a lot of theories around Trump and Trump's candidacy,
sure,
including that Trump is secretly an agent of the Clintons, that the Clintons pushed him to run. It's debatable. Maybe that's possible. I'm perfectly willing to entertain the theory, and I'm certainly willing to entertain the theory that Trump doesn't even really want to win, that Trump is in this to build Trump's brand and that he never expected to get this far. In fact, I think that's probably quite likely. But ultimately, whatever got him here he is, and he's tapped into something very significant in the American psyche, both on the positive and especially on the negative side. And I think that a lot of people, especially those who are supporting Trump for some good reasons, some bad reasons, they are oftentimes ignoring the danger that Trump represents. And let me be clear about what I'm saying here. It's not Trump himself who represents a danger. It is a movement that is coalescing around Trump and around the most deeply reactionary policies and deeply reactionary outlook that he has put forward. That is what is truly let's say disheartening, maybe even frightening from the perspective of the United States. If you know the history of the U.S. and you know what kind of virulent racism and white supremacism has kind of been suppressed under the surface for these last few decades, that is now having full expression in the Trump movement. And so the question I would pose to listeners for them to consider is not what Trump represents right now. It's what's going to happen to that movement once Trump, the individual, leaves the public stage. What's going to happen to that movement when the next politician who's slicker, who's a better speaker, a better politician, a slimier person comes along and adapts Trump's politics and adapts Trump's language, but does it in a more public relations savvy way? What's going to happen then? And is the left and everybody else going to be prepared to take on that challenge? I fear that we are not ready.
Well, yeah, it's clear that he's had a profound effect on the Republican Party and what they come up with next. Yeah, it really is scary. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Eric Dreitzer. Eric's a New York City-based independent geopolitical analyst. His articles and interviews can be found at his site, stopimperialism.org, and at counterpunch.org that we're talking about tonight. He's the host of Counterpunch Radio. Now, tell me, Eric, a little bit about this fundraising campaign. I know it's really difficult, even for an organization like Counterpunch, it's got millions of people that follow it daily, to really raise the money needed to keep on going. And we know that people on the so-called left are pretty so-called cheap as well. So how's the fundraising going so far?
Well, I think it's going okay. I think Counterpunch is getting close to meeting its goal, which is really important, because without meeting that goal, Counterpunch will then have to scale back a lot of what it does, and that includes, of course, a print magazine, that includes a digital version of the print magazine, that includes a number of other things, and it also includes Counterpunch Radio, because it costs money to host the website, it costs money to use the server required for putting the podcast out there, and so forth. And again, I want to stress one thing here. There are a number of, let's call them liberal or progressive media outlets in the alternative media space who have a large staff of individuals who have major grants and major funding coming from very powerful, very wealthy sources and benefactors. Counterpunch has almost none of that. Counterpunch is a very small operation, and yet it really is, in many ways, in my personal opinion, an outpost of the left. It is one of the few faces that can be counted on to have consistently critical analysis of major issues, and that includes political issues, that includes economic issues, social and cultural ones, environmental issues. That's a major aspect of what Counterpunch does. And, you know, it might be easy to ignore or forget, but anybody who's put together a website in recent times knows that it's not what it was in 1999 or 2000. Today, everything is monetized. You want to have any feature on a website, it is monetized. Counterpunch has a redesigned website that they've rolled out in the last year. That costs a significant amount of money. Searchable archives, so people can go on Counterpunch and do research. They can search by authors. They can search topics and keywords. That costs money. All the back-end stuff costs money. The printing of a magazine, forget it, incredibly expensive. The point here is that in order to maintain one of these very last sanctuaries we have of independent analysis and critical perspectives, it requires a commitment from the people who benefit from it. For me, I'll tell you right now, on any given day, I might spend between $3 and $10 on coffee in the morning and maybe even in the afternoon. What if I took that money and gave it to Counterpunch? What would I feel from doing that? I would feel like I was a part of maintaining a space on the left in the media. I find that very valuable as somebody who works in media, as somebody who does this work. I think it is critically important, and I hope people will consider that. Forget that latte at Starbucks. Give that money to an outlet that is putting out great content. Counterpunch is not mining other sites for content. It is almost all original content submitted directly to Counterpunch that comes from nowhere else. Almost no sites anywhere can boast that.
Well, Eric, and for people listening in our footprint here in Victoria, you may not realize it, but you're a beneficiary of Counterpunch too, because as I said, dozens of the guests that appeared on this show over the last 17 years, 18 years, have come because I went to that site and educated myself first and then reached out and contacted those people. Many of those authors are reachable through the work that the articles they put up at Counterpunch, which has helped me and this show a lot over the years. Eric Dreitzer, thanks a lot for coming on the show. Stopimperialism.org is Eric's site, and counterpunch.org, if you want to help out, go there and you'll be able to find out how to do that. Thanks a lot, Eric, for coming on the show today and telling us about it, eh?
Hey, thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.
All right, then. Bye-bye. Now, I'm going to take a brief break. When I come back, I'll be joined by Janine, and she's going to bring us up to speed with local goings-on, so do stick around for that. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Joining me now, as off time she does, is the Victoria Street News publisher emeritus and CFUV radio broadcaster in her own right, Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine, how's it going?
Well, Chris, I had a phone message from someone I knew from Street News days, and she said that she doesn't have a computer. I think she lives on a pension of some sort. Who can afford anything extra, right? Mm-hmm. So she turns to CFUV for all of her news, basically. So somebody's listening. She was quite concerned because we had talked about the women on the boat to Gaza, and she was quite concerned about what had happened to them. Mm-hmm. So I'll just provide the update that they were detained. They were detained for 2 days, which is quite a short time compared to other flotillas, and they believe that the reason for that is of the enormous support that they're getting. They're getting more media coverage now, Al Jazeera and others. But they were taken against their will, and they report, some of them, that they were prevented from sleeping during their time in detention. Mm-hmm. They're all home. They're all good. And I would say, you know, go to the library. They have computers, and check out the Women's Boat to Gaza and Counterpunch. And you could spend your whole life in front of a computer these days, right?
Well, and you could go to my site, to guerrillaradioblog.blogspot.ca, and do a search for Kevin Nisch, N-E-I-S-H. I've interviewed Kevin many times over the years, and he was taken prisoner off of the Mavi Marmara in that very infamous boarding that nine and then eventually a 10th person were killed. What was that, 2009 or 10?
Yeah, I can't remember. Yeah,
but he talks about his experiences in custody there and how things were stolen from him and, I mean, money and other stuff.
So. Right, a much different thing happened back then. So things might be changing, you know. And the other thing is, I don't know if you heard about the vote in the United Nations today on the Cuban blockade. They do this every year. Mm-hmm. A little bit of a change this year. Did you hear?
No, I haven't heard.
Oh, well, the U.S. and Israel, who typically vote against the blockade, have abstained from the vote.
Oh, so does that mean the blockade gets lifted, or what?
I don't know. I've been looking on the Twitter, and I can't seem to... I've been doing other things, too, but I haven't... I don't know, so that's something we can investigate.
Oh, yeah. Cuba C, blockade oh no.
That's right. That's bloqueo no, si, for sure. So they're pretty happy in Cuba, from what I can see.
Yeah, well, the sun is shining.
Speaking of Israel, though, you know, I had Dimitri on my show last week from the Green Party. He's the guy who wrote the resolution that the Green Party adopt support for the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement.
And Dimitri Lascaris, yeah.
Right, yes. And then the leadership is all up in arms. And so now they're going to have another town hall. And the membership had chosen Calgary as a sort of central place to have this. But apparently there's been some blowback from... Yeah, so they're now the church that they tried to go to in Calgary has declined the rental because concerns for security of church property, which, you know. So anyways, another fascinating thing to follow, Dimitri Lascaris, there's a Facebook group, Green Party Support GPCBDS, and get involved with that. Another one.
Well, had the church been threatened, Janine, do you know? Was there any threats against the property or people made?
Well, I did hear sort of, I can't confirm that the B'nai B'rith and the Jewish, what are they called, the funding group, perhaps provided some pressure to the church in terms of what might happen. Planted fear, perhaps. I don't know. I'm just speculating. Mm. But that's what I've heard on the street.
Hmm.
Yes. So, anyways, back to Vancouver now. Tonight, there's a Sightsee Town Hall, another important... Is there any end to the important things we need to be talking about? The Premier Clark's $9 billion heist, they're calling it. The Wilderness Committee is inviting everyone to a Sightsee Town Hall meeting tonight, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Roundhouse Community Center in Vancouver. We need to know about this. We need to talk about it. We need to stop it.
Well, look at Muskrat Falls in Labrador, another huge and controversial hydroelectric project, but they're billions over budget. So when you say $9 billion, I think that's a pretty hopeful estimate.
Yes, and also breaking news that the government of Newfoundland and Labrador have agreed to limit the impacts of Muskrat Falls. Again, I haven't looked at the details on that, but I would check the APTN news tonight, and they'll be covering it, I'm sure.
Yeah, good news source.
Yeah, really great news source for all things environment and with all this stuff going on. So back to Victoria now. Thursday, tomorrow, between 3 and 4 p.m., there's going to be a discussion about electoral reform. There is a Minister of Democratic Institutions, apparently, who is going to be coming to Victoria to host this. And there's a round table. And this is happening at the Harbor Towers Hotel and Suites, 3 till 4 p.m. on October 27th. On Friday, Cafe Simpatico is presenting Dr. Bill Carroll to do with music videos, research, and climate justice. Bill was a Street News supporter. I'll let folks know that. And very cool guy. Mm-hmm. And he wants to talk about how we can use social media, I think, and music especially to fight for global justice. So Cafe Simpatico is at 1923 Fernwood on Friday. There will be a little bit of music happening at 7:30, and the presentation is at 8, and admission, as always, is by donation. On Saturday in Vancouver, the Stop Kinder Morgan Inters action at Broadway and Cambie at noon till 2. So they're going to be flyering, talking to people, got some petitions and banners to do with Kinder Morgan Saturday. Also on, Sunday now, Halloween Against Kinder Morgan, October 30th at Grandview Park. This is about getting dressed up in your Halloween costumes, bring your music, and just a chance again to chat with folks about it, get informed, have some fun. Grandview Park Sunday at noon in Vancouver. In Victoria on Sunday at 7 p.m., is a discussion about the LEAP Manifesto. You know, this is sort of a lot of really well-known people, trade unions, political groups.
Naomi Klein and such, right?
Hey?
Naomi Klein and some other luminary types.
Yeah, sadly, no vegans, because that part is not mentioned, which, science says, and it seems clear, that environmental impacts of animal agriculture, whether it's corporate or individualized, is a contributor, a significant contributor to climate change. And sadly, that portion is not included in the LEAP Manifesto, despite the efforts of many concerned people. So this is a place to go raise that, perhaps, at 7 o'clock October 30th at the Clarahue Building, room C112 at UVic. And then just looking forward, Chris, you know, there's been over 120 people arrested at the Standing Rock in North Dakota. Mm-hmm. Democracy Now! Has been covering it. APTN's been covering it. And I just saw that there is concern that, you know, we might be looking at a similar situation. The crap might be hitting the fan up at the Unist'ot'en camp. They're preparing for that starting in April next year. Mm-hmm. It could happen sooner, but they're in preparation mode. So if anybody can do anything to start thinking about that and supporting it, now's the time.
Yeah, and they've been up there how long now? Is it 5 years?
Many years. And, you know, they say that pipeline would have happened by now if they hadn't been there. Oh, 7 years.
Holy smokes. Yeah, well, and now the market has collapsed on the fracked gas and everything else. So, I mean, they've done us a lot, a big favor, really, by slowing it down.
Oh, huge, huge. We really, really, this is our chance to make up for what all those crazy white ancestors of ours have done to the indigenous people.
Crazy white guys, I tell
you. Stand with these people and support them, because this is the only way we're going to save anything, I think.
Okay, well, is that all then?
Well, I'm sure there's more, but that's what I got.
Yeah, well, there is more, but you do have more. Your program, that The Winds of Change, alternates with Nnedi Mjari's Hidden News, Thursdays at 11 a.m., alternating. Tomorrow is Mehdi's turn, right?
Tomorrow is Mehdi's turn.
Okay, well, we'll tune in for Mehdi tomorrow at 11 and you the following Thursday. Thanks a lot again, Janine, for coming on and keeping us apprised.
You bet. Thank you, Chris.
All right. Till the next time, then. Now, I'm going to take another brief break. And when I come back, I know I had Igmar on last week, but things have been developing so quickly up there with the sinking of this tugboat, the Nathan E. Stewart, and the subsequent oil slick right in the middle of the Great Bear Rainforest. It's worth revisiting. As always, the connections up there can be kind of tenuous, but I'm going to try to get a hold of him right now. But in the meantime, there's a new disc up here, and I listened to a track off of this earlier in the week, and I was really taken by it, but I can't find the particular track that I really liked. So I'm playing another off of Kate Tempest's new disc, Let Them Eat Chaos.
Everywhere is monsters, dicks out, wet mouth, heads back, shouting and screaming just to prove they exist. Becky's at the bar with the usual mix of decadent fabrics and desolate lighting. Everybody here has got a hyphenated second name, blowing more breeze than the wind at the weather vane. Industry slime balls, showbiz big deals, the cool new band with the retro fills, the rap party for their video. Becky danced in it, the director, martial law, head to toe in yellow velour, is holding court about the science of image, while the sycophants giggle and grimace. Becky fidgets, tells herself, must stop being so cynical. Everybody here is a human, even these pitiful, posturing pop stars and idiots. She tells herself to look again, nothing is hideous. So while Marshall Norris knocking on about his artwork, she smiles at the guy opposite, bright eyes, dark shirt. He raises his eyebrows in the direction of Marshall. My name's Becky, she says, what's yours? She was like nothing that he'd seen before. Strong body, soft edges with something so raw. In the core of her iris, he said his name, Harry. And never in his life had he felt so happy. They got talking, free bar, exhausting decorum. He drank until she was so absorbing, he blanked out the party. The floor spun, he stared at her face and felt sure something was happening here. He was kinda nervous, his eyes kept doing circuits in the room. He drank as fast as they could serve him. Then this dude comes over, sticks out a thick hand, and Harry looks at her like he's just found himself in quicksand. He gives this guy a rap, they shake hands, sweaty cash pass between palms, no fuss, bish bash, yes bosh. He looked at her guiltily, she waved it off smiling. You were shot at it, right? I don't care. Becky, all I ever wanted was a place of my own. His eyes wide and trusting, he's staring at her, desperate for something to click. He is opening up. This is it, a real classy place, the whole bit, like a speakeasy, right? Chandeliers and lights that shine off of the glasses, no hypnosis or salt. Instead of rotting our guts out, it's dishy on boozers. We can be grown men, music, real music, played with heart by real bands, not just posers looking like they're giving Bush wallops to mic stands. And I'll be in a waistcoat, dead grand, Harry's place, or at least that's the plan. She was half listening, half not listening, kept getting distracted by the lights flickering. He looks like an outline that needs filling in. He leans in close, starts whispering. The thing is, and it's weird, I never felt so able to talk like this to anybody ever. Recently, Becky, I've been really feeling the pressure. I can't tell you how good it is to get this off my chest. Becky's holding tight to her gloves. Good coat, brain fast. She watches his face as she talks. Little bump on her fingertips. Expert, quick snort. Sucking on a cigarette, feeling vaguely bored. It's true if you believe it. The world is the world, but it's all how you see it. One man's flash of lightning ripping through the air is another's passing glare. Hardly there. It's true if you believe it. The world is the world, but it's all how you see it. One man's flash of lightning ripping through the air is another's passing glare. Hardly there. If I'm being honest, well it is, it's like a trap. I ain't trying to be flash, I just need to raise the cash for the dream. I hardly touch it myself, look it ain't that. But once I set myself a task.
Kate Tempest and hers, Let Them Eat Chaos, off her new disc here. Well, last week, Denny Island-based ecology observer Igmar Lee reported on the sinking of the Kirby Corporation's oil tanker tug Nathan E. Stewart. It went down about 20 kilometers north of Bella Bella, right in Igmar's neighborhood. Now, almost 2 weeks later, the Nathan E. Stewart sits yet at the bottom of the Seaforth Channel, spewing its fuel tank, diesel oil, and other lubricants on board into the environment. Welcome back to the program, Igmar.
Hey, Chris. How's it going?
Okay, it's going all right, but it doesn't sound the same up there. What's the latest?
Well, I'm told that there's hardly any media coverage of this event down your neck of the woods, but I can tell you up here it's an absolutely massive event that's impacting every aspect of life up here. There are more than 200 people dropped into this tiny little remote area. We've got, salvage experts and divers and WCMRC, like that's the Western Canada Marine Response Corporation. There's personnel all over here. They brought in huge camps. The Shearwater Corporation is absolutely plugged with people. They've got their restaurant is, everybody's all there working overtime, and, people are frankly exhausted. Every business is, just going full steam. Oil slicks are big business, no question there.
Yeah, well, and the GDP is going up, so, I mean, who's to complain, right?
Yeah, I guess so. They're really, really shoveling money. Now, talking about the big bucks, I was just got in the door from, I took a cruise out to Norman Morrison Bay. Now, I don't know who the heck Norman Morrison was. It's a horrible name for such a beautiful bay, but it's a bay at the north end of Campbell Island, which Bella Bella is on Campbell Island. And up at the north end of the island, there's this bay, Norman Morrison Bay. And the really huge assets, as they call them, of the salvage people that are working on resurrecting the wreck of the Nathan E. Stewart are staging their assets there. So last week they brought up what I thought was a massive crane, just an enormous crane on a barge and with a bunch of other cranes on it. And so there was a whole bunch of tugs and barges and hanging around the bay. And then a few days ago, this 10,000 horsepower offshore tugboat, the Resolve Pioneer, showed up, and it's been anchored there. And it's got a 6-ton anchor, which is, it's the size of a pickup truck, massive, heavy steel anchor. There's one of those on deck. And then just this morning, the tugboat Gene Dunlop towed in the most colossal crane I've ever seen. It absolutely dwarfs the massive crane that showed up last week, and it is apparently easily able to lift the 400-ton wreck of the Nathan E. Stewart. Now, this boat also has enormous anchors on deck, and the problem is that they can't bring the barge much more than a cable distance. It's about 100 yards or so from the wreck because of all the reefs in the area.
Right.
So they have to drop these great big anchors down and secure the crane barge into a position. And then, as I understand it, for the next week or so, the divers are preparing the wreck. They're cutting big holes right through the hull of it, and they've got to string these enormous chains through these holes. Now, these chains are much too big to be manhandled. It's quite a complicated operation, just getting the chains all secured around the wreck so they can drag it off. And apparently that's what they have to do. They have to drag the wreck off into deeper water, closer to where the cranes are, to where they can lift it out of the water up onto the deck.
Well, yeah, it's like, as I remember, it's in 30 or 35 feet of water or something sitting on the bottom in the middle of the channel, right?
Yeah, it's something like that. It's maybe not that quite that deep. I'm told by the divers that actually the wreck is sitting quite nicely on a pretty flat reef, and they didn't think it was really in danger of getting washed off of that. It's, as it turns out, it's sitting right on top of a bed of endangered abalone that are, you know, off limits to fishing because they're so endangered. Like the Haltvik here mourn the loss of their abalone that they used to be one of their staples. The tug's sitting there, and at low tide, you can see the main cabin as well as the wheelhouse on a pedestal that towers up over the deck that they claim provided them with some visibility across the 300 and some odd foot barge that they're designed to push. And that's just sort of sticking out of the water there. It's this forlorn outpost surrounded by reefs and these big ocean seas.
Yeah.
At the entrance to Seaforth Channel, you can discern that very distinctly that the ocean waves are, you know, much bigger and roller. They're big rollers that roll in from the ocean as opposed to the wind-driven chop that we get around the archipelago.
Well, Igmar, you mentioned the Haltvik and the seabed is where they get their livelihood. They're trying to raise money. I mean, so much for the world-class oil spill response. They've got a fundraiser that's R-A-Z-E-R, you know, trying to raise money online, like a GoFundMe campaign. They're out there trying to mitigate, however they can, the damage that this is causing. What about this response to all this?
Yeah, well, I don't know about that. I do know that the Kirby Corporation has had to kick in $250,000, and you know, they're, of course, Kirby's putting it out there like they've kicked in the $250,000 out of the generosity of their hearts. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that that money is basically to cover the Haltvik volunteers who have been working on the beaches out there with all kinds of horrific work. Now those people are being paid, and as I understand it, the Kirby Corporation offered to pay a kind of an insulting hourly rate, and some of the very smart negotiators there asked what the Kirby people were getting paid, and found out that it was more than double what they were offering to the Haltvik. So now everybody's getting the Kirby rate. It's a kind of a disingenuous gift. It's not a gift at all. It's just a chunk of money to cover the operation of basically trying to save what they can out in their clam beds. I think the one thing that, you know, I'm very loth to start going into the sort of mitigation aspect of this, because from what everybody can see here, one thing that rings absolutely loud and clear is that even though the oil industry-owned Western Canada Marine Response Corporation has every single piece of equipment that it owns, all of its booms, all of its semi-truckloads full of containment, so-called containment booms, every asset that that corporation owns is right here on scene. So God help us if there's any further accidents anywhere else in British Columbia. But and no matter what they throw at this, they can't even clean up what is a comparatively small spill. I mean, we're talking about a massive spill here. Don't get me wrong. It's 60,000 gallons of diesel in the water. But the fact is that comparatively, like, I mean, if the tanker that this barge was pushing had been full and breached, we would be talking an order of magnitude huger spill, to the order of, you know, 2.2 million gallons. And they're absolutely incapable of dealing with even a diesel spill of this small magnitude. It just puts to lie the concept that this material can be contained or even recovered after it's spilled at sea.
Well, and where this mishap occurred, I mean, it's relatively close. I mean, I know you guys are pretty remote up there, but 20 kilometers from Bella Bella, at least there's an airstrip at Bella Bella. There's infrastructure available. This Kirby and these this pusher tug full of oil, they go to some of the most remote regions in the world up and down our coast here. If this had happened a few hundred miles to the north or who knows where, I mean, there'd be no response at all, I expect.
Well, that's true, Chris, but I can tell you that in spite of all the gear and all the equipment and all the people and everything, you might as well say there's no response at all, because right. they're just absolutely impotent. They're absolutely useless. Now, the reason that they're absolutely shoveling money at this thing is largely because, A, it is, as you say, accessible, but B, is because we are on the very verge of hearing the announcement by the big oil lackey Prime Minister Trudeau that he's about to approve the Kinder Morgan pipeline. And, you know, all eyes are on the response to this spill cleanup, and the corporate media and especially the CBC are very, very determined to try and create a media frame that says that this kind of material is recoverable and that the spill cleanup is going along.
Or that is the big problem, that, oh, the problem here is that the spill response wasn't great, but we can make it better, so don't worry, you can go back to sleep and we've got it under control. It seems to me to be the message.
Yeah, that's the frame. Yeah, we've made some mistakes, but we have the technology. I understand that the response here that so far is they're up to somewhere around $40 million.
Wow.
Into it. And, you know, they're just basically shoveling money right now. I mean, they brought up this other crane last week that, you know, the one I thought was big, and it's apparently too small. But it's just to create the chimera that there's something going on here. Mm-hmm. And I think that everybody really needs to know that, you know, from any perspective that's out there on the water, it's just a joke. It's a bad joke. They cannot clean this stuff up. It cannot be recovered at sea. It cannot be gathered. Their booms are utterly useless, and I've seen no sign of any booms out here that can actually contain diesel everywhere, even on flat, calm days. You go out there and look at the booms, and the diesel's just going through like it's a piece of mesh.
Yeah.
You know, they've got all these containment booms out there, but even the stuff that's being contained is not being gathered. They're not, gathering it up. They don't have any machinery or any equipment to get it out of the booms if some was actually contained. There's no slick liquors or whatever, no sign of any of those. So just a total farce and a lie.
Well, Igmar, we saw down in the Gulf of Mexico, the oil company involved there used this chemical Corexit that basically sank the oil, just took out of sight, out of mind kind of thing, which proved to be even doubly disastrous. Do we have any indication, Igmar, that there's plans up there for Corexit to be sunk into the environment?
I haven't heard of any of that, those dispersants or Corexit or any of that. I've been watching for that, and I haven't seen any sign personally. Now, that doesn't mean they're not out there using it at night or something like that. I wouldn't put it past them. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of sleazery. I've heard some of the buzz talk that you hear around Shearwater from the WCMRC personnel is, for example, this diesel, it just evaporates,
right.
And all this fuss about the clams. And I overheard somebody the other day saying, these clams, when the tide goes out, they shut their mouth. So they're not contaminated, and, all this fuss,
they're holding
that
their
sort
breath.
Of thing. They're definitely, amongst all the cleanup people, if you question what they're doing, they immediately get their backs up and they all talk about, we're working our ass off out there and you guys are always negative. And I just go, you're working your ass off at a big oil industry public relations propaganda show.
Yeah.
Good for you, you're working your ass off, but you're helping their fake message.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Igmar Lee. Igmar is up in Denny Island in the central coast area of BC. That's what we call it nowadays. The Great Bear Rainforest is another name that it's been given by we. And we're talking about the Nathan E. Stewart, the disaster long predicted. I don't want to make this a story about you necessarily, Igmar, but you've been talking about this on this show and in other venues for an awfully long time. For those that haven't tuned in, can you just give us a thumbnail of what the Nathan E. Stewart was all about before it sank?
Well, the Nathan E. Stewart is a 100-foot-long tug that fits. It's designed to fit into a special notch cut out of the transom of a 10,000 deadweight ton capacity oil barge. And it clamps into this notch with its bow with these giant pins, and then it pushes the barge rather than tows it in the conventional manner. And the Nathan E. Stewart was doing anywhere from 20 to 30 trips a year up the entire BC coast from the Kinder Morgan Westridge terminal in Burnaby or the Ana Cortez Tesoro refinery, all the way to Alaska, hires no Canadians, no Canadian pilots, and no stops in Canada. So we want this business, like the Nathan E. Stewart wasn't the only vessel doing this run. There are a number of other ones to the tune of, as far as my observations have been able to, I'm sure there may be a lot more, but I've been able to estimate about 50 trips a year to the tune of 500,000 deadweight tons. Going all the way to Alaska. And so now one of these has sunk. The busiest one has sunk right here near Bella Bella.
Well, now, Igmar, why big tankers have to go along the outside of Vancouver Island and Haida Gwaii to get back and forth between Seattle or Vancouver and Alaska? Why are these guys even there? Why aren't they just getting their oil in the conventional sense? Don't they have facilities in Alaska to handle this? Or I don't understand. Why are these things even necessary?
Well, there are about five refineries in Alaska, but apparently they're very far on the north, and they would have to bring their refined products down the Alaska coast, and maybe the Alaskans are more concerned about their coast than the powers that govern our coastal waters. and they don't want them plying back and forth in these dangerous tug tanker vessels. I really don't understand it. To me, it just it seems like an absolute no-brainer politically, environmentally, economically to stop this horrific traffic up our inshore, our beautiful BC Inside Passage, and make them get a proper seaworthy tanker and run 20 miles offshore, just like the other tankers all have to do. It's beyond me, Chris, why they allow it.
Well, Igmar, we're kind of out of time here, but I noticed, now you've been running your website on the Facebook there, 10,000-ton tanker. That's the number, 10,000-ton tanker. It's a public site. Anybody can go. You don't have to be a Facebook devotee or anything. You can get it up. And I noticed that you've got a posting up there about a mysterious other tanker that's beetling around up there for no apparent reason. The Navig 8 Aeronaldo, I think, is, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but what's the latest on that? Are they still up there doing curlicues, or do you know anything more?
Well, it's actually bizarre, because I was tuned into my ship tracker last night, and I was going to follow the Gene Dunlop, which was bringing in that great big crane I was talking about, when I happened to notice this tanker doing loop-de-loops off of Bull Harbor at the north end of Vancouver Island. So I'm not used to seeing big 37,000 deadweight ton tankers in that neck of the woods. So I had a look at it, and this morning when I woke up, it was in off Aristizable Island in Laredo Sound, and it's headed for Kitimat. So I have spoken with the chief pilot, Captain Obermeyer, and he says that what they were doing was taking on two Canadian pilots. Now, I don't think that Canadian pilots can guarantee the safety of the ship. I don't have that kind of confidence in any human being. I don't think that's the solution. And I hate the idea that Hecate Straits,
right,
and beautiful Laredo Channel and Whale Channel and Douglas Channel are being exploited to use for these oil chemical tankers. We don't know what that tanker was carrying. There is speculation that it could be diluent, because they need some kind of chemical lube to get the bitumen through the pipes, for Kinder Morgan, and that is said to be delivered to Kitimat.
Right.
I've heard all kinds of speculation on what could be in that tanker, but it was surprising to me to see it in southern Hecate Straits. You don't usually see these big tankers in there, and a very distressing sight.
Well, Igmar, we'll keep in touch, and 10,000-ton tanker to monitor what's going on our coast. It's being rapidly industrialized is what it is. Igmar Lee, we're out of time. Thanks a lot for coming on again, Igmar, and bringing us up to stage, eh?
Thank you very much, Chris.
All right, bye-bye. And also thanks to Eric Dreitzer, counterpunch.org. Go check it out. Janine Bancroft, all the good people up here that keep the wheels spinning week in and week out. I'm going overtime, but Linda's coming straight up, and there's a lot of good stuff on this show, your favorite radio station, The Voice of Victoria. Stick around for that. Until the next time, that's all I've got for this week. Take me away, Kate.
Till it's difficult, and nothing don't heal till it hurts. They call him Rags.
Why?
Because he leaves bodies in tatters. Not the type of man to be flattered. Eyes like patches on a bloodstained mattress. Taps on the window when it shatters. For now he sits down heavily, his voice is soft. Some junior Joey trying to play boss, for he could run a scam. And now he lost about a key and a half. Whatever a small cost to find a snake in the grass. And yeah, Pico ain't happy, but you know, well, the game plays on. We think the kid's called Harry.